Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the meeting of TV news anchors and executives in Trump Tower, where they were subjected to a tirade of abuse from Donald Trump, who called the news executives liars and the journalists lowlifes, singling out CNN President Jeff Zucker and other network heads who had lavished Trump with $5 billion worth of free media throughout the campaign. Jason Stanley, a professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of How Propaganda Works, joins us to discuss the extraordinary ground rules that Donald Trump appears to be trying to impose on the press. We will examine what seems to be Trump's confusion about the roles of public relations, propaganda, celebrity publicity, and a free press, and that what Trump is demanding is a press like the one that Putin enjoys in Russia or Erdogan has now in Turkey. Ironically, since Trump could only find washed-up minor TV actors like Scott Baio to endorse him while all the big stars put on free concerts for Hillary Clinton, having now made it to the big time, this insecure bully expects to be loved after spreading such hatred. Then we look into Trump's trillion-dollar infrastructure plan that Bernie Sanders has blasted as corporate welfare coming and going, as well as the many conflicts of interest that are emerging as he resists putting his businesses into a blind trust. Jared Bernstein, a senior fellow at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities, who was formerly the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, joins us to discuss his article at Politico, Trump's Misguided Flirtation with Keynesianism, and whether the white working class who were seduced into voting for Trump will be left stranded at the altar. Then finally, we'll assess whether the budding secession movement in California is a serious prospect or a hissy fit in response to the election of Donald Trump, who, thanks in part to California, came up 2 million votes short in the popular vote. Appearing on a statewide ballot in 2018 is likely to be the question, should California become a free, sovereign, and independent country? And we will speak with Dan Walters, a political columnist at the Sacramento Bee, where he has an article, Could California Succeed If It Became a Nation? And joining us now is Jason Stanley. He's a professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of 4 books, 2 on epistemology and 1 on philosophy of language and semantics, as well as 1 on social and political philosophy. His latest book is How Propaganda Works, and he has a recent article at the New York Times, Beyond Lying, Donald Trump's Authoritarian Reality. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jason Stanley.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And do you find it at least a little strange that the press that gave Donald Trump $5 billion worth of free publicity was hauled over the coals in Trump's tower yesterday, where Trump apparently was incredibly abusive to both the network executives and the TV anchors?
Yeah, it's shocking, but I mean, I've never witnessed this before in this country, but it's to be expected given how he ran. I think the TV networks, I think it's of a piece, actually. I think the television networks didn't understand what he was doing, and so that's why they gave him all the free time, and it was profitable. We can't let them totally off the hook. One of the things they say is, we thought the more America saw of him, the more they would see how untenable his candidacy was. But that didn't occur because he was doing something else. And I think that explains his current behavior. I mean, I think what's at issue for him is power. Like, the presuppositions of our press and our media are that there's some constraint on truth. Like, you know, if you have an argument, you deal with it with facts. But in other societies, you can have an argument by dueling. So, you know, bias for the president-elect means something different. It doesn't mean deviation from the truth. It means not recognizing who has power and behaving appropriately, which is also explains his campaign rhetoric and his campaign strategies. I mean, here's an example. Take Attorney General, the Attorney General that he has well, Jeff Sessions, who he is, his nominee for Attorney General. Sessions said last week, you can tell that the president-elect is a law and order president from his response to the Central Park Five case, where Trump called for their execution in 1989 and called them crazed misfits. And he's doubled down on that, even though they've been exonerated, proven to be innocent. So law and order now has nothing to do with who's innocent and who's guilty. Law and order means the expression of power.
Well, that's frightening that an attorney general would have that outlook and attitude. I mean, I covered him yesterday, or a critic of his was on, but my God, that's an extraordinary attitude for the top law enforcement officer in the land who's supposed to protect our rights to have that kind of belief system.
Yeah, well, you know the case in 1985.
Oh, I do. Yeah. I know about the Central Park kids who were scapegoated.
I meant the case that Sessions...
Oh, the Sessions case, yes, exactly. Yeah,
no, the voter fraud, the bringing people up in charges for voter fraud.
Right.
I mean, that's the thing. But in terms of the technical machinery of communication with the media, one needs to shift the game from truth to power. So I remember one time I was in an argument in some kind of debate, and it was about politics, and I'm an academic, so I deal in arguments. And there were academics present, but they were saying things that were inconsistent with what they believed, what they had written. And I was kept on being confused about it. And then later at night, I was at the bar with one of them, and he said, "You don't get it. When you're at war, then, you know, it's different. You're not trying to win the argument. You're trying to win the battle." So I think we've been sort of communicated to that a certain sort of ethic is coming. And democracy is a culture, first and foremost. It's a culture of respecting the truth, equal respect. There's another kind of culture, which is the kind of culture where you resolve arguments with duels, and it's power that matters. And that's an anti-democratic culture. That's a non-democratic culture, what my colleague Steve Darwell calls an honor culture, Anthony Appiah calls an honor culture. And in an honor culture, you know, it's just power. And so the press is going to have to keep truth alive. That's going to be vital in the future.
Well, I'm reminded of what Hermann Göring is supposed to have said. Whenever I hear the word culture, I reach for my Luger.
I don't think we should. There are different things going on here. There's Trump, and then there is Bannon and Pence, and there are different ideologies here. It's right. It's nationalism. You're absolutely right. Bannon is clear about it. It's nationalism. And nationalism... Well, that's the view that one ethnic group, one specific group, is better than others. And of course, Hitler's view in Mein Kampf was that, the Jews represent this idea of universality, that we can all be equal, and they're bringing us the Enlightenment. Now, you can have that view without anti-Semitism. You can say, Israel is not... sort of ethnically based, is of course ethnically and religiously based, at least nominally. So you can have that nationalist ideology, but it's incompatible with liberalism. Because a press in a liberal democratic society must tell the truth and not favor one group over another. And that's what it means to be non-biased.
And again, I'm speaking with Jason Stanley, who's a professor of philosophy at Yale University. His latest book is How Propaganda Works. He has a recent article at the New York Times, Beyond Lying, Donald Trump's Authoritarian Reality. So if Donald Trump was just sort of having a hissy fit, inventing, and it's hard to understand why he thinks that somehow they're lying, because... they're not, frankly. And so this gets into a kind of Orwellian world, doesn't it, where truth.
You lose the norms of truth and falsity.
Yeah.
Because it's about power. And what bias means is not recognizing that I have power now.
I see.
So, he's quite right that they're biased in that sense. But he's never given us any indication that the culture that he represents is different. But, you know, there are different forms of anti-liberalism, and Trump's is only one. I mean, if you, you know, if you put religion in front of liberal values, like Ted Cruz said, he's a Christian first, an American second, and a Republican third. Pence has said he's a Christian first, a conservative second, and a Republican third. You know, American doesn't make the list. So those, you know, you can get authoritarianism in different forms. Of course, because the thing about liberal democracy and our values is that truth has to come first. And, you know, that's supposed to be the equalizer between different groups.
Sure.
And, you know.
But given the atomization of the media and the rise of social media and the internet,
absolutely,
there is no consensus on what is true anymore, and that makes the landscape, rather roils the landscape, wouldn't you say?
I have been writing about this for 5 years, and I didn't expect it. I started writing. You know, I'm a philosopher of language and an epistemologist who studies communication and how it conveys information. So I started working on this on the press, on Fox News. In 2011, my first New York Times piece was on Fox News, and it was about this, ways of silencing, and my second piece was media and mistrust, about the Fox News slogan,
fair and balanced,
yeah, which they know, and their readers know, and their viewers know, is not how they're thinking of themselves. They're thinking of themselves as rather counterbalancing, because the idea really is that there's no fair and balanced. By fair and balanced, they're saying that the New York Times is biased, and they're biasing in the other direction. So, but the problem is, just as you say, I mean, the problem is we have set the groundwork for this. You know, the attack on the mainstream media, well, a lot of people think the mainstream media is biased and in the sense of lying. And so then the worry is we've set the groundwork for a anti-bias in media law, which, like all such laws, will mean the reverse.
Well, let me pose a couple of points here. On the one hand, what leverage Trump may have over the press, and two, what leverage we, the majority in this country, who lost this election, may have over Trump. And so, it's beginning with the first,
lost it in the Electoral College.
Well,
we won. Won it by 1.7
right,
million.
Which is how the rest of the world's democracies, yeah, operate. So I don't think I'm being unkind. But the leverage that he would seem to be exercising, or at least threatening here, is that he can basically shut out the White House press corps and the mainstream media and hand all the exclusives over to Drudge and Breitbart.
Breitbart, yeah.
Yeah. On the other side, the Achilles heel seems to be this kind of insecure bully wants to be loved even after spreading such hatred, and he wants to be, accepted by New York in particular. The boy from Queens who's made it good, he's made it all the way to the president. How come we're all not, you know, falling down and bowing before him?
I don't think I understand that that narrative of his psychology, and I agree that one is going to have a theory of his psychology in the years to come. But when in Bannon's discussion in the Hollywood Reporter, I mean, remember Bannon has two sides, the Jekyll side and the Hyde side. So he has the Institute that did Clinton Cash, which is fact-based. And he used the New York Times to give them perfectly legitimate, true information. As Bannon said, you know, facts can be the ultimately persuasive thing, you know. So, you know, there you really lose. Bannon knows that you lose credibility if you eliminate a press system like. I mean, that's a serious threat to American power. Is removing our free press or threatening our free press? So. I hope, you know, I hope they won't do that. And I think that Bannon is his chief strategist. Not that I'm looking to Bannon for sanity.
Well, I'm not saying that much. They're threatening it. They're kind of circumventing it. Is it possible to do that, do you think?
Everyone's just going to have to, those are technical questions. I mean, I think that under threat of authoritarianism, I'm not saying the president-elect needs to show the country that he isn't the person who made the three picks of for attorney general, for Michael Flynn, for security director, and but if it's authoritarianism, I think we all just have to do our jobs. And this is what my colleague Tim Snyder says in his 2020 Dallas Morning News piece, 20 Rules, keep to professional ethics. And with the media, that means, keep to telling the truth, even though it's going to probably get hard on the individual members of the media who he seems to be naming by name.
Well, I'm sure you recall, Jason Stanley, the extraordinary audio of Donald Trump calling up public relations firms, pretending to be somebody else, and talking about himself in the third person. This seems to be a strangely obsessed person with celebrity and fame. And again, the fact that he's not been able to attract any real celebrities except Scott Baio, and apparently he's furious with Beyonce and these other people for supporting Hillary Clinton. You don't think that there's any that's an Achilles heel, that he needs to be accepted, and it in order to be accepted, particularly by the people in this country who are shocked by his presidency, isn't it up to him? Do you think, in other words, am I being naive in thinking that the man who insulted everybody owes us all an apology as opposed to we owe him obedience?
We definitely do not owe him obedience. If he wants to hang out with Jay-Z and Beyonce, who are two of our most are sort of both political and artistic leaders in this country, and then he needs to not have Jeff Sessions as his attorney general. So, I mean, there's a perfect path to being accepted by the elite, and that's being a good president and not catering to to racism, not catering to people who are anti-democratic, who call major religions cancers. And so there's a clear path. There's no way to obedience celebrities, any one of us, into being your friend. But he could shock us all by not nominating, not following the path of appointments that he's so far suggested. I mean, the problem is it just looks.
There's not a lot left, I'm afraid.
There's not a lot left, and no. So who's going to join a cabinet of this kind? So it's clear what he has to. We cannot normalize. We cannot switch to an ethic where we're okay, that person has power, and therefore I'm not going to speak the truth. And so what's going to happen is that. I assume there's going to be mechanisms of individual humiliation for journalists and doxing and hate. I mean, I've been getting hate mail I get occasionally hate mail, but, I assume that will happen, reputational destruction, like in Russia, some of the media tactics they use. So you already have lots of different media outlets here, and they'll focus on what, like Daily Caller, for instance, that took down Stephen Salida. They now it's in academia, they're just going after people, screenshotting tweets, and then doing out-of-context articles to do reputational damage. So they'll probably, it's probably much worse, we already know it's much worse for journalists, right? Mm.
But just in closing, though, Jason Stanley, do you think that, I mean, I'm trying to be charitable to this person who I think is an absolute disgrace, and it's shocking that he has risen to the most powerful position on the planet. But maybe because he comes out of business, that he sees the press as something to be played, and that he doesn't see the difference between journalism and public relations.
I think he's only operating with a metric of struggle.
Right.
And what the Enlightenment did is it said, okay, let's end the struggle between Christianity and Islam, and let's be guided by the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a way of equalizing human beings and recognizing the common humanity in all of us. And he wants not to do that. He wants to dominate and win. And
right. Well, but then the other side, which is his apparent fascination with authoritarians, particularly Putin, is that to do with, considering your work, how propaganda works, is that to do with a desire to have an obedient press that essentially is a stenographer of power?
Well, yeah. I mean, the problem is there's an authoritarian playbook. So, you know, I do not want to believe the president-elect is going to be an authoritarian, but we all have to assume that he will be, unless told otherwise, unless we have some counter-evidence soon. And Plato tells us in Book 8 of the Republic that every tyrant enters office, you know, calming fears, and he's not even doing that.
That's a scary reality, isn't it? Well,
yeah.
Jason Stanley, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I enjoyed talking to you, and I hope we can do it again.
Very much. Thank you very much.
You too. And again, I've been speaking with Jason Stanley. He's a professor of philosophy at Yale University and the author of 4 books, 2 on epistemology, 1 on philosophy of language and semantics, and 1 on social and political philosophy. His latest book is How Propaganda Works, and he has a recent article at the New York Times, Beyond Lying, Donald Trump's Authoritarian Reality. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into Donald Trump's trillion-dollar infrastructure scam.
Looking for a sign. I'm looking for the treason that I knew in 65. Beware, the South is yours. Oh, 1984. Oh, see, come see, remember me.
They got it on my movie roll. You said it would last, but I guess we grow.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Jared Bernstein, who's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. From 2009 to 2011, he was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. Prior to that, he was senior economist and director of the Living Standards Program at the Economic Policy Institute and held a post of deputy chief economist at the U.S. Department of Labor. He has an article at Politico, Trump's Misguided Flirtation with Keynesianism. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jared Bernstein.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
And Bernie Sanders has come out swinging, if you will, against Donald Trump's proposed infrastructure package, saying, quote, Trump would allow corporations who have stashed their profits overseas to pay just a fraction of what the companies owe in federal taxes, and then he would allow the companies to invest in infrastructure projects in exchange for even more tax breaks. Trump's plan is corporate welfare coming and going. What do you think of that?
That's a correct assessment, and he quite nails it, in fact. It is actually, in my mind, pretty straightforward to do the type of infrastructure investment that we really need in this country right now. Our public goods are in great need of a simple allocation of resources to fix our roads, bridges, particularly our water systems, communication system. There's so much we could be doing. And yet Trump team apparently has come up with this basically tax cut privatization scheme where private investors get a tax credit that's north of 80%, which they can put towards infrastructure projects, which must, by the way, deliver a return. So it will only work on things like toll roads and any other infrastructure that spins off a user fee. Not a good idea.
So at the end of the day, if they build these toll roads, of course, they end up with a revenue stream.
Correct. So this is basic privatization 101, and it would be a terrible idea at any time, but particularly when we don't need to waste revenue on this kind of a tax cut for high-end investors, and more to the point, we have such really deep needs for investing in our public goods.
So the question I think that looms here is about the promise to drain the swamp. And, you know, clearly Donald Trump did get the white working class in the Rust Belt to vote for him. In many ways, they bought into that Republican right-wing narrative that the reason for the job loss is to do with immigrants, unions, and government regulations. And but at the end of the day, it's my suspicion, and many other people too, that the people who voted for Trump, the white working class, will be seduced and abandoned. And the first signal to show that is that the top priority of the new Republican Congress is to stop President Obama's overtime, time and a half, that's coming in, going to be come into law on December the 1st. They have made that their top priority, to literally any worker that earns under $47,000 is going to be denied time and a half pay for overtime, thanks to the Trump administration and the Republican Congress. So isn't that right out of the gate a signal that they don't give a damn about the working class who voted for them?
I think it is, and you have to understand that this overtime rule was a very important update of a threshold that had been ignored for many decades, below which, so this is a salary level below which you must be paid overtime. Back in the 1990s, it was set at about $23,000. If you index it for inflation, it should be up around $47,000 right now, going back to when this thing was set. And simply put, it just means that middle-class workers who work more than 40 hours a week are going to get a fair shake to have time and a half when they work overtime. Now, in some cases, they're going to find new income in their paycheck from working overtime. In some cases, they're going to end up not having to work overtime that they wouldn't otherwise be paid for. So this was a huge win for the middle class. Congress had nothing to do with it. It was a rule change that President Obama put in place. And it's actually going to, no matter what Donald Trump does, it's going to be implemented on December 1st. So it's in the books. What the Congress is going to try to do is kill it. It's the old Bob Marley song, kill it before it grows. They're going to try to kill it in January when they come into office. It's not clear if they'll be able to do that. If they can't do it quickly, then they'll try to unwind it. That could take as long as a year. But the point is, these are all details. I mean, your point is the one that holds. How is taking overtime away from middle-class workers who earn between about $25,000 and $45,000? So we're not talking about millionaires and billionaires here. We're talking about middle-class people working more than 40 hours a week and yet being denied time and a half overtime. This rule gets it to them. Now they want to take it away. Completely inconsistent with this faux populist agenda.
And again, I'm speaking with Jared Bernstein, who's the senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. And he has an article at Politico, Trump's Misguided Flirtation with Keynesianism. And, I mean, the irony here, of course, Jared Bernstein, is that if in many ways, had Obama been able to get through a real infrastructure project when he had the trifecta, when he came in 2008 with the House, the Senate, and the White House under Democratic control, which is the situation the Republicans now have, we may be living in a very different country. There's no question that Eisenhower benefited from making the highway project a part of the national security infrastructure. And if Donald Trump were to do this, not in terms of crony capitalism, but in a real way, he would be an extremely successful president. So the question looms out there. What's your sense? Do the Republicans Congress see the establishment and the Koch brothers, etc., see Trump as kind of a useful idiot who got them into power and got them the trifecta? Or is he going to assert himself in a different way?
Well, I mean, I don't know the answer to that question, and neither does anybody else. The things that we've been talking about in this phone call are real. We know that this is the infrastructure plan that Trump has proposed. We know that the Congress is gunning for the overtime rule. But we haven't really heard the president-elect weigh in on these things himself. And I will say that during the campaign, when it was pointed out that Trump's tax plan was completely unrealistic and lost so many trillions in revenue simply to enrich the very top, they went back to the drawing board and they came back with something that was still really lousy, but not as big a loser as before. And so I thought perhaps this team is not completely impenetrable to criticism, but I'm not that hopeful because, you know, Donald Trump is not really he doesn't impress one as being a detail guy when it comes to policy matters. And so you worry that he's going to outsource these things to people who really do the details, like Paul Ryan, but do them in a way that is completely inconsistent with helping working families. So I'm quite worried about how your question is going to play out, but I must say we don't know the answer yet, which is one reason why people like myself are trying to raise these issues as best we can.
Well, the other issue we know very little about, and it's looming, and that is the extraordinary conflicts of interest that Trump poses in terms of his overseas business ventures, his children taking over for him in what he calls a blind trust that is not a blind trust by any definition. He's ties to China. He's indebted to the Bank of China, who loaned the Trump-affiliated office building in Manhattan $950 million. He had met with Indian businessmen just last week about building luxury apartments in India. He's been on the phone with the Argentinians. And his daughter apparently joined that call to the new president of the Argentine, where Trump has office building projects. In Saudi Arabia, he's exploring hotel deals on the Red Sea port of Jeddah. And, of course, he's involved with Germany's troubled Deutsche Bank. They have $3.5 billion in loans to Trump entities, $350 million from banks tied to Trump's properties in Miami, Chicago, and Washington. And so I could go on. I mean, this is not draining the swamp. This is drowning in the swamp.
Well, the point is that he's not the first president to come into office with business dealings, although we've never seen anything like this. And you, as you said, you just gave a very partial list. But it's never been a question as to whether those former presidents would put their assets in a blind trust. We have yet to learn what Donald Trump plans to do in this regard. He has certainly bucked tradition throughout the campaign. And again, as you said, we'll have to wait and see. To me, it's all thematically very much connected to this idea of bait and switch. Run a populist agenda, and then once you get your hands on the government, use it to advantage the billionaire class of which you are an upstanding member. So I remain deeply concerned about everything we're discussing.
Well, but we know that he had these strange meetings with the broadcasting executives and back and forth with the New York Times, and it's pretty clear that he wants to rewrite the rules of coverage of a presidency. It does seem that he sort of wants a press that's friendly, like the Putin-controlled press is in Moscow or in Russia, and that Erdogan, who's just taken over the press there. And, you know, we know that Les Moonves and CBS and others loved the ratings during his rise. They gave him $5 billion worth. Now he's basically saying to them, OK, you know, you got to play ball with me or I'll hand everything over to Breitbart. I mean, this is an extraordinary moment of hubris, of chutzpah, for a man who lost an election by 2 million popular votes.
Yeah, that last point you made should not be lost on anyone. We have a very obvious electoral college problem. This is the second in five elections where the victor has lost the popular vote, although, of course, George W. Bush lost the popular vote by a few hundred thousand or something, and, you know, in Donald Trump's case, it's close to 2 million. So, look, I think the question here is, to what extent are people paying attention, and to what extent is resistance futile? If there is a very strong bottom-up movement among people who are saying, wait a second, this is not at all what we voted for, that can only help. I can't tell you that that will solve the problem, but I think that our biggest enemy right now is a kind of checked-out apathy. We've just had this long, incredibly divisive and ugly campaign. The result was one that left many people deeply shocked and disappointed, and there's a sense that there's nothing we can do about the fact that the president-elect is seating his cabinet with someone who's a known white nationalist and talking about violating ethics rules that have been in place forever. To the extent that those of us listening just decide, well, what can we do? That's okay. Let's go back to our lives. We certainly make it easier for him to accomplish those goals, if in fact that's what they are. My contention is that these people are just kind of bumping around in the dark and just figuring they can do whatever they want. I think that we need to insist that that's not the case.
Well, it does seem for Donald Trump, psychologically, it's important for him to see himself as a winner. In fact, I don't know whether you remember hearing those audio tapes of him calling up public relations people and pretending to be somebody else and talking about himself in the third person. I mean, it'd give a shrink a feeling.
Well, who of us hasn't done that? No, just kidding.
No, but I'm saying it really makes you wonder about.
No, believe me, I'm not. Look, I'm an economist, not a psychiatrist. I'm not going to put this guy on the couch. But it is absolutely remarkable that we are where we are. And I think there's a kind of numbness setting in that you open your paper and say, okay, white nationalist right down the hall from the president. He's going to try to keep his business holdings. He's got his daughter on calls with foreign leaders. This is the age of Trump, and that's just how it's going to be. That isn't an America that I recognize, and not one that I will willingly accept, and I suspect I'm not the only one who feels that way.
Well, but I was going to say that it seems that Trump's Achilles heel is that in spite of the fact that he ran a campaign based on hate, he wants to be loved, particularly by the New Yorkers who've never totally accepted him. And now he's got the biggest prize of all. I'm now the president. And they still won't let him into their inner circle, even though he's this bombastic billionaire who's been trying to prove something all his life. For the boys from Queen has a huge chip on his shoulders, we know. So to my mind is that the very least we can do is this guy who sees himself as a winner needs to be reminded on a daily basis that he's a loser, and he has to show some humility to the majority of the Americans who voted against him.
Well, perhaps that's true. I think the other side of that equation is beware of a wounded tiger who has immense power, not to mention the nuclear codes. I'm not at all suggesting that a Donald Trump who feels jilted by some large portion of the electorate would do something crazy, but I'm not saying he wouldn't. So I don't know. Again, we're into a realm of discussion here that really isn't my forte. I think about policy and the economy and exchange rates and unemployment and all of the above. But
let's turn to that then, just in the last couple of minutes, because I'd like to get a quick macroeconomic picture from you. We are at a time when a recession is not to be unexpected, shall we say. Krugman is talking about how Trump may give the economy a short-term boost, but then it's really going to go to hell if, you know, if they go after the Fed, they raise interest rates. We could be in for a rough time. What's your reading on the macroeconomic landscape?
I don't see the odds of a recession as a lot higher now than they were, or really much higher than they were at all in recent months. And the fact is, nobody knows, even the brilliant Paul Krugman, where the next recession is. But I do know this. We're not ready for it. And it's out there somewhere. And I suspect, just based on the length of the recovery, even though you can't really go from the length of the recovery to the next recession, historically, you know, this recovery is kind of long in the tooth. So the next recession is out there somewhere, and we're not ready. And here's where a Trump presidency, and this is in my political article, concerns me. The Federal Reserve will be unlikely to do enough to provide monetary support in the next recession, and that's because interest rates remain very low, and that's where they should be. Now, they may be slowly raising them. Perhaps if the Trump sugar high boosts inflation, they'll raise them a little quicker. But it's possible that we'll get to the next recession, and the federal funds rate, the interest rate that they lower when we hit a recession, will already be plenty low. There won't be a lot of room to move there. They won't have had time to reload. So that leaves us with fiscal policy. Well, we know we're going to have a tough Congress, but we also understand that if Donald Trump has his way and is able to pass this huge, wasteful tax cut, which we haven't even really been talking about yet, we're not going to have much fiscal space to do what needs to be done. So I am concerned about that dynamic.
And just in closing, that Trump's proposed tax cut for the rich is, what, three times what George W. Bush did?
That's correct. It's in the $6 trillion range over 10 years, and Bush's was closer to two.
Wow. Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Jared Bernstein.
My pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Jared Bernstein, who's a senior fellow at the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities. He was the chief economist and economic advisor to Vice President Joe Biden, executive director of the White House Task Force on the Middle Class, and a member of President Obama's economic team. And he has an article at Politico, Trump's Misguided Flirtation with Keynesianism. And we're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back assessing whether the budding secession movement in California is a serious prospect. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Dan Walters, a political columnist for the Sacramento Bee, covering the state of the state capital since 1975. He is co-author of The Third House, Lobbyists, Money, and Power in Sacramento, and he has an article at the Sacramento Bee, Could California Succeed If It Became a Nation? Welcome to Background Briefing, Dan Walters.
Thank you.
And then this question of California succeeding may well be something that we'll have to be thinking about in the future, because the Yes California group filed a proposed ballot measure with the Attorney General's office on Monday that on the November 2018 gubernatorial ballot, we may have a proposition that asks the question, should California become a free, sovereign, and independent country? What do you think the chances are of this thing being a serious movement, or is this just a sort of hissy fit in response to the election of Donald Trump, who, you know, thanks to California, came in about 2 million votes short?
Well, it's probably something of a hissy fit, and it's probably something of a serious movement. Whether we all actually wind up voting for it is, it's hard to say. You know, only a small fraction of the ballot measures that are filed with the Attorney General's office ever actually make it on the ballot. I think there were over 100 filed this last year, and we wound up with 17 on the ballot, not all of which were initiatives. Maybe about 15 of them were. So the ratio of proposals and success is pretty small. But it's possible. It's possible. If the people are serious enough about it, they'll go out and hustle signatures or get our deep pocket to pay for putting the enough signatures on the ballot. So we'll see. You know, it's a possibility.
Well, I just noticed the other day Senator Ted Cruz was speaking to a conservative group in Washington, and he was quite contemptuous of the blue states and the coast, particularly California, and said that the election of Donald Trump was a victory for flyover America, the red states in the middle, and we're going to show those people. Well, you know, that kind of stuff, frankly, is likely to irritate Californians, and it's often said that California gives a lot more money to the federal government than it gets back from the federal government, and in effect, it's subsidizing some of these states, not necessarily Texas, but certainly Alabama and Mississippi and these other red states.
Yeah, that's true. And the question is, however, would that money be sufficient to finance a country, a sovereign nation of California? And I think there's some reason to doubt that. Remember, there's more to it than just we pay so much in taxes and get so much back. And for one thing, the federal government finances a lot of its stuff with borrowed money. Secondly, there's things that aren't counted in that, like military protection. That's about $800 billion a year that the feds spend on military protection of our share proportionately is something like $100 billion of that. So would California be willing to pony up another $100 billion for its national defense? I kind of doubt it. So there's, you know, from a financial standpoint, could we make it? Yeah, we could. We have as much viability as Canada. We have a little larger population than Canada. We have an economy that's about 40% larger than Canada's. So, yeah, we could, on economic terms, if we're willing to shoulder the burdens of nationhood, if we're willing to create a military and a diplomatic corps and undertake all the expenses. And we also have to remember that were we to leave by some chance, and how the mechanism would occur, it's very much up in the air. Would the federal government want us to pay for Yosemite and all that desert land and all the military bases and all the other stuff that the federal government owns in California? Would we have to buy that to get our independence? What will we do about the people who are getting Social Security and military pensions and so forth? How are we going to take those up as expenses if they happen to be Californians? There are a lot of unanswered questions about how it would actually work. Yeah, I think it's theoretically possible that California could survive as a nation, given the size of our economy and the size of our population. But it would be a complicated thing, without a doubt.
And again, I'm speaking with Dan Walters, political columnist for the Sacramento Bee, covering the state capital since 1975. He has an article in the Sacramento Bee, Could California Succeed If It Became a Nation? So the president of Yes California says the group plans to go through the United Nations to seek independence because they don't believe Congress would sign off on a California exit plan. I think they got that one right.
Well, I'm not so sure. Maybe the rest of the country would be willing to get rid of California. We seem to be irritating much of the country as it stands. But again, that the country, then the nation of the United States of America, would have to give up about 12% of its population and a big chunk of its economy if California were to leave as well.
Right. It's often, the fifth or the sixth largest economy in the world. So
yes, it is.
And that's the, I think, at the heart of the issue here, that we sort of have two Americas, the blue state and red state. And the blue state part of America is tends to be more outward-looking and more economically successful and certainly more entrepreneurial in terms of Silicon Valley and the future economy. And the reverse is true in much of the red states. So I guess we're going back to that brief moment, right, when the Bear Flag Republic was founded.
It's a very brief moment, yeah, back before California became a state in 1850. The other thing that would occur, of course, is that were California to leave the United States, and there would be 49 states rather than 50 states, it would probably be a pretty red country without California's counterbalance. So it would we would be kind of abandoning, in a way, our kindred souls in places like Massachusetts and New York and Connecticut and maybe Illinois and Washington and Oregon, who are about as blue as California is. So we would leave them in the lurch. They would there was 55 electoral votes that the Democratic presidential candidate could not count on in the future.
Well, the extent to which the question which we posed earlier, Dan Walters, is whether or not this is a hissy fit or a serious proposal, I think you can at least look at what happened when Barack Obama got elected, right? Didn't the state of Texas talk about secession?
There was secession. And within California itself, there's talk of secession. There are counties up on the border of Oregon have been touting the idea of the state of Jefferson for the last about 70 years. It actually was a pretty serious movement in the late 1930s. It kind of got ended by World War II because the people in southern Oregon are feel just as alienated from Portland and Eugene. So there was talk about creating a state of Jefferson of the northernmost counties in California and the southernmost counties of Oregon. I mean, but it's been talked about for 70 years and it never happened.
Well, that's kind of the Bundy brothers country, isn't it? I mean,
maybe not quite Bundy brothers country, but it's a more conservative. Certainly, that's where Trump won in California most heavily was in the northernmost counties. So within the state, where we have the same kind of alienation, just the state Senate's president pro tem said something like, "We feel like we're aliens in a foreign land after the Trump victory." Well, the people up in North California feel like they're aliens in a foreign land as well. So all of these kind of what you might call nationalistic fervors get stirred up when you have a campaign like this. My guess is people will talk about it for a while and nothing will happen.
Well, apparently people are talking about it on Facebook since the Yes California Independence campaign emerged after the election. Their likes, I guess, are expanding exponentially, and they're even dubbing the movement a Calexit, playing on the Brexit.
But, talk is cheap, and if they're really serious about it, they'll go out there and hustle 400 or 500 signatures to put that actually on the ballot. If they don't do that, then they're not really serious about it, right?
Right. Well, I have a feeling that they're out there in the zeitgeist is a certain amount of anger at
I'm sure there is.
Particularly the idea that if you did get rid of the Electoral College, of course, then all they do would be campaign in California and New York. So, but on the other hand, the fact that
the red states would feel like they were being neglected as well, right?
Right, but the fact of the matter is that they use California as an ATM. And don't campaign here, and you don't even know that an election is going on, and then suddenly, the guy you didn't vote for won.
California was a red state, and it wasn't that long ago when you think about it.
Right.
I mean, you go back to the 1980s, Republicans were winning statewide elections overwhelmingly against Democrats, and even into the early 90s, that was true. And so is it going to swing back? No, it's probably not going to swing back because there's been a lot of demographic and social and cultural change since then. But California has been there before. California was an outlier for a long time in a different way. They were the red state back in the days when the Democrats were dominating national politics.
So do you think there's another way that California could assert itself in the sense that to remind the rest of the country, particularly if it moves – far to the right, which it appears to be doing with the selections in the cabinet, like Sessions at the Attorney General. He's a sort of remnant of the old South. A lot of hardliners in defense, it looks like. I think the Californian political consciousness is going to be further and further insulted.
Well, no question. This was, in many minds, this was going to be an election in which the rest of the country moved closer to California. Instead, it moved further away from California. And I think that's I think the exit, or the Calexit, or whatever you want to call it, movement comes out of the shock of what's happened that was not supposed to happen, that was unexpectedly. Mm-hmm. And it, we'll see if it wears off. Now, that's not to minimize the fact that during the Trump presidency, however long it lasts, there's going to be a wide gulf between California and the national government. But we have to remember that there's an old saying that he who pays the piper calls the tune. And much of what California has done in the liberal sense, like expanding health care to millions of additional people, is only possible because the feds put up the money. And if the feds take away that money for that program, and as well as a number of other programs, then California would have to go it on its own. Now, are Californians willing to put up maybe $10 billion more a year to pick up the health care for the people who are who came under Obamacare and might lose it? If in fact they do lose it, would California taxpayers be willing to pick up that tab? That's a question that we might have to face in real life, not this theoretical stuff of Calexit, but in the real world terms, California is quite dependent on having money from Uncle Sam for a variety of things, but particularly for health and welfare and to a certain extent education programs. So we will have those battles, probably. And California is going to have to make up its mind, because if the feds take away their money, they'll take away their money, and there's not much we can do about it other than maybe supply, make up the difference ourselves if we're willing to do so.
Well, but again, the Californians were the ones that made Obamacare work, and the rest of the red states, the governors, did everything they could to sabotage it. And now the Republicans are going to step in and kill it at the national level.
Well, if they do, then California has a decision to make.
Exactly.
It's going to pick up that bill for health care itself. And it's a lot of money. It's an awful lot of money.
Right.
And there's not much California can do about that. If Congress, Republican Congress, and the President of the United States say no more Obamacare subsidy money, then California is going to feel the pinch more than any place else, because we were more active in implementing it than any place else, and we get more money than any place else.
Right, but maybe we'll be...
dilemma for California,
sure,
to pick up that slack.
Right, but maybe we're poised better than anybody else to move in the kind of state-financed single payer, which is a more efficient system. And we go back to your analogy earlier with Canada. So,
but are we willing to pay the freight? By the way, I mentioned in that article about that Canada only spends about $6,000 per person from all sources on its health care system. In California, we spend almost $10,000 per person,
right,
on average.
Well, Dan Walters, I thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
All right. You're welcome.
And again, I've been speaking with Dan Walters, his political columnist for the Sacramento Bee, covering the state capital since 1975. He's the co-author of The Third House, Lobbyists, Money, and Power in Sacramento. And he has an article at the Sacramento Bee, Could California Succeed If It Became a Nation? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.